You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Oh, don't be sniffy about
I'm not
pens.
Being sniffy.
I think
I'm
you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show...
Don't you want to learn to be glamorous?
All my retina sees is the photons bouncing off your face.
I had a dream that my guitar had moose antlers.
First and foremost, they were fabulous.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
When you're walking through a gallery or a museum and looking at a piece of art, a painting on the wall, what is going through your mind? I mean, not colloquially, what is seeing that picture actually doing to your brain? That is a question that absolutely fascinates Eric Kandel, and he tries to figure it out in his new book. Kandel is a neuroscientist at Columbia University. He won the Nobel Prize a few years ago for his research into how we form memories in our brains. He's also a big art fan.
First of all, I've been interested in art. Much of my life, I took a wonderful fine arts course when I was at Harvard.
Who do you collect?
I collect...
Turner, Rothko?
Yes. Klim, Kokoschkin, Schiele.
Really?
Munch, Beckmann, yes. But these are works on paper. I'm an academic.
Okay.
Not a broadcaster.
You're not a rich public radio person.
That's right.
This book is called Reductionism in Art and Brain Science. And we are used to thinking of reductionism or reductivism as a pejorative thing.
Pejorative.
Oh, you're being reductive.
Yes.
That's wrong.
Yes.
So explain what you mean by reductionism, which is not that.
Not that at all. Often what both either scientists and artists do is to take a complex problem and say, I'm going to take one component of that and try to understand that deeply. In my own work, I have been interested in memory storage. And I started to work on this problem in 1957. I made some beginning progress of understanding how the cells work. But then I realized we don't know anything about how learning process is modified. So this is too complicated. I took a simple reflex that could be modified by simple forms of learning and analyzed that. So for that, I went to a much simpler animal, a snail called a plesia, had a much simpler nervous system, simple reflexes, but they showed beautiful forms of learning that could be easily analyzed, and I've spent much of my career analyzing them, and I've made a lot of progress with that.
And snail memory, however, it's not just, oh, snails are simple, and who cares if we hurt them. Their memory is not unlike human memory?
Well, my initial assumption is, and this is the assumption of everyone who takes a reductionist approach, is that evolution is conservative. And once it finds a mechanism that works, it holds on to
it. Good enough.
I'm speaking about
yeah.
it anthropomorphically, but this is...
Right.
I was the first one to show that learning involves a change in the strength of synaptic connections. That has turned out to be universal.
Huh. And so synaptic connections are connections between the neurons,
the
cells
in
the brain. So I see how you and other scientists reduce these complex processes down to their most basic fundamental versions in snails or whatever to understand them. So how does that work in art?
Well, artists often use experimental approaches that are very similar to scientists. Chuck Close and Richard Serra said, creativity is for amateurs. We solve problems.
Well, let's look at this picture that happens to be on the cover of your book, this Rothko, which is, like most Rothko paintings, several rectangles of color.
Right.
Are you saying that that's reductionist because instead of trying to paint a picture with faces and trees and castles and horses or whatever, he's just reduced it to these chunks of color? Is that what you mean by reductionist?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Then we're done.
No. He doesn't have any form, any figuration. He's exclusively focused on color, and he puts bars of color together.
Right.
And when you stand in front of a Rothko, you see what you can't see in the picture, that each one of these bars is layers of paint. So there's a veil on top, but underneath it you see glowing, the particular color he represents in that bar. And it flickers and it varies. And when you stand in front of it, I, like everyone else, almost a religious experience. The first time I really sat for a long time in front of a Rothko, I said to myself, you think you're a reductionist? You know, this guy is a real reductionist.
So in the way that you look at a snail's brain to figure out the way the human brain might work, he is reducing the picture to getting rid of the figurative elements and just making it color in order to, What's his goal? The way understanding the human brain is yours, is his understanding the nature of consciousness or God or what?
To convey to you through that image a sense of spirituality.
Yeah. Okay, I'll buy that. So, Mr. Neuroscience, what does neuroscience tell us about how the brain processes images, including pictures, works of art? Walk me through that.
So right now, when I look at you, Kurt, all my retina sees is the photons bouncing off your face. That is grossly inadequate for me to reconstruct you the way you are, but I reconstruct you this way. Other people see you the same way. So clearly, other sources of information are necessary.
Uh-huh.
There are now two additional sources of information that allow me to use that, bottom up and top down.
And explain what you mean by those two terms, bottom up and top down processing, because they come up a lot in this book.
Bottom up is the fact that your visual system has evolved over millions of years to solve this problem. So you have built into your brain lots of rules that tell you how to perceive things. So if you see a source of light, you assume it's above because the sun comes above. If you see two people, one much larger than the other, you assume the larger one is closer to you. This is built into your brain. This is what evolution accomplished in the visual system is to give you bottom-up processing.
Uh-huh.
But in addition, you have a personal life, you have relationships, you have experiences, you have looked at art, you've listened to music. Those learned experiences, your life story, bears upon your perception, all perception, but certainly your perception of art, and in particular, perception of ambiguous art, like abstract art.
Uh-huh.
So the two interact in a very interesting way.
It's as though you're saying the bottom up bit is sort of the operating system. It is there in a physiological way in all humans, whereas the top down is more the software of the moment for where you happen to be from or where you happen to grow up or when or whatever.
Completely. But it doesn't simply describe a response at the moment.
No, I understand.
You can bring to bear, you know, events that you recall from 20 years ago.
Right. So let's look at this Monet for a second.
Yes.
One of his many, many water lilies paintings. What did that, this high impressionist thing he did, which we all love now and was kind of shocking and extraordinary at the time, what does that tell us about the way our brains perceive images?
Well, you look at this image and there is some detail, but there are a lot of things that are quite vague. So you need imagination and interpretation in order to really make sense out of it in your own head. So you recruit top-down processing, your own thinking, your imagination, your experiences. And I don't know whether you function like I do, but I have the lousiest little idea and I feel good about it.
Right.
One gets pleasure out of one's attempts at originality. And so looking at this and struggling to see, you know, what exactly is going on in these spaces in between the water lilies. Is this water? Is this just murkiness? Are these lilies that I don't recognize?
Right.
I mean, that keeps you going for some time, and it's really quite wonderful.
Right. And then, so 50 years later, leading art was entirely abstract.
Yes.
In many ways. So what is that require the brain to do that it wasn't doing before? That you make that argument that it's actually different parts of the brain are at work.
It recruits this top-down processing, which is based on you, not as a machine, but your personal experiences.
Right.
The associations you have with different forms of art, your own imagination in response to something that you see. So this is a creative process that you are undergoing to a much greater degree when you look at an abstract work of art than a figurative work of art.
You're participating in what you're seeing.
Right.
You talk about James Turrell, who is one of my favorite contemporary artists.
He's fantastic.
And he does lots of things, but two of the things he does, one is he
Ganzfeld effect. He submerges you in—
Yes, in a color.
Absolutely.
Basically. And it's
Remarkable.
It's remarkable, and it sort of puts you into a trance. The other thing he does, which is more extraordinary because it seems like, well, this can't be art at all, is he builds frames around the sky, essentially, and you stare at the sky. And I'm as big a skeptic as anybody, but I went into one of those Terrell skyboxes thinking, this is silly. And being moved by the experience.
He is an amazing artist. He started off as a cognitive psychologist, and he used that cognitive psychology in a very creative way. And I have in the book someplace here a couple of images by Terrell, and one of them looks like a box of light. He creates this out of using light in a particular way that tricks you into thinking this is a physical structure.
Right.
There's no, you walk in there, you can put your finger right in the middle of that.
No, I often, after I saw a few Terrell pieces, I said, well, if there is heaven, I think it kind of looks like this.
That would be nice.
You know, it would
be
nice.
That would be very nice.
It would be nice.
Yes.
So again, neurologically, what did he discover? What is his secret
you
trick?
See, you give us much more credit than we deserve it. We don't understand how the brain responds to something like this. We have made tremendous progress.
So he's out in front of you in a way.
Way in front of us.
Huh.
We've made a lot of progress in understanding the brain in the last 70 years. But how far have we come compared to what needs to be done? 10 or 20%.
Right. As you have thought about and studied and written about the neuroscience of perception, has that changed the way you look at art, the art you own, the art you see in museums?
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, I study it more carefully. You know, it hasn't really changed my taste dramatically. But, you know, the more you study something, the better you get at it and the more you enjoy looking at the new things.
Uh-huh. And it doesn't stop you from enjoying it because you know too much?
Oh, not at all. That much I don't know, first of all.
Uh-huh.
Not at all. I mean, the more you know something, the more you enjoy it.
Right. Professor Kendall, it's a pleasure, and I hope I can have you back.
Well, that would be very nice. It's extremely interesting to talk to you.
Well, likewise.
Thank you for having me here.
Eric Kendall's new book is called Reductionism in Art and Brain Science. Coming up next, think it's expensive to be a record collector in America? Try Indonesia.
Dizzy Gillespie goes for at least 300,000 rupiah.
The epic search for old records in a country where a record hasn't been produced in decades. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Sell peanuts, sell peanuts.
Studio 360.
Rock music lyrics are filled with larger-than-life characters.
Lovely Rita, meet a maid.
Roxanne. Mary, Mary.
But a great song written in the early 1970s had characters who weren't just larger than life. They were a group of specific real people. To tell the story of this song, we have an author.
I'm Richie Unterberger. I'm a rock historian.
A director.
My name is Catherine O'Sullivan Shore. I wrote and directed a 3-hour series entitled Andy Warhol's Factory People.
And somebody who watched that song come together firsthand.
My name is Betty Kronstad. I'm Lou Reed's first wife. And I'm writing a book about our relationship, my life with him, and the title is Perfect Day.
Just a perfect day.
When I first met Lou, he was in the process of leaving the Velvet Underground.
Lou Reed left the Velvet Underground the end of the summer of 1970. He moved back with his parents in the Long Island suburbs, worked for his father's accountancy business, typing, doing really functional, drab work.
But he was also regrouping to see about whether or not he wanted to continue in a musical career on a solo basis or if he wanted to go into writing, you know, and just become a poet.
In 1971, he was approached with the idea of kind of doing a musical adaptation of the Nelson Algren novel, A Walk on the Wild Side, which by the standards of its time, the mid-20th century, was a very earthy, even kind of seamy look at these street-level characters.
And I think within a week, you know, it didn't take very long, he didn't have the job anymore. But he kept the title, Walk on the Wild Side.
Holly came from Miami, FLA.
Holly came in from Miami, Holly Woodlawn.
Hitchhiked away across USA.
She was a he who was being a she.
Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Well, today we use these terms like transgender and transsexual, sexually fluid, and all it might apply to Holly, but they would have hated being pigeonholed because they were, first and foremost, they were fabulous.
Even if you didn't have direct experience with transvestites, which must have applied to a lot of teenagers who bought this hit single when it came out, you could figure out what was going on.
She didn't exactly shave her legs, as Lou wrote. She waxed her legs.
And it's not negative or it's not really celebratory. It's just very realistic.
This is what Holly would say. Of all of them, I loved Holly. We didn't think we looked like women, she'd say. We just want to get high and get laid.
So, just because people don't like it and they have no use for it, that don't mean it's garbage. I have use for it. I deserve it.
Candy came from out on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head. Even when she was given head, she says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side.
Candy Darling, she was a transvestite also. And like Holly, she had a great sense of humor.
We're rich, we're famous, we're beautiful and miserable.
Candy was very beautiful and serious. You know, she was a lot of depth. Very beautiful.
She was painfully beautiful, actually.
Don't you want to learn to be glamorous?
Candy. And for the first time in the top 20, we have a song talking about oral sex.
So it's a modest breakthrough in that way. No matter what you felt about giving head, to have that not just on FM underground radio or in your home, you heard it everywhere.
Well, that was how they made their money. And they live very flamboyantly, yet they were in the shadows. You know, they worked their trade out of the trailers in the meat market. And there they'd be with the platform heels, clattering along the blood-stained cobblestones.
Little Joe never once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, Joe, take a walk on the wild side.
Little Joe was Joe D'Alessandro.
Joe D'Alessandro was an actor in several films that emerged out of the Warhol factory scene.
And he was this muscular, straight, studly guy. I just loved the way he performed because he was just so deadpan. And he's a serious actor. I mean, he's still working.
Do you have that underwear?
No.
Well, how am I supposed to make any money without clean underwear?
Did you wear that?
And in these films, he played this character who we would call kind of a gigolo.
But, I mean, they didn't call it prostitution. So as far as they were concerned, they were just making some money and having fun.
You don't have to follow everybody. You know, do more or less what you want to do. And what you like to do is make bread, right? Make it
fast.
Yeah,
right.
Right. So the easiest way to do it is, you know, what you're doing here, looking for those dirty old men as they walk by, right?
Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that patch. She said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.
Well, Jackie Curtis was James Dean one day, and the next day he would decide to be a drag queen. And he was the wildest of all of them. I mean, just put on a new dress and just rip it up and say, well, it's a look, isn't it? Amazingly talented.
Do you know any poems? Starving for culture.
And everybody was on speed all the time.
Even a reference to Valium, as there is, was very unusual because you're mentioning a product, a drug product by name.
Jackie would get up and you'd see her putting the speed in the coffee and she'd say, I don't really take drugs. I just put a little something in my coffee in the morning to get me going.
I think A Walk on the Wild Side was a hit in spite of having all of these taboo references in its lyrics because it was a really catchy song.
It is. It's a very catchy tune.
You probably got these people who were really afraid of thinking about these subjects or thought it was wrong to sing about them, liking the song before they realized they were listening to a song that was talking about unconventional sex and transvestites and drug use.
Take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
The women who are actually singing the chorus on the record, the backup singers, they're not African-American. They're white. But they sing in a way that was popularized by black women soul singers.
I don't think anyone took it seriously. I think the song screams, have fun, embrace life, you know, just walk down the street, have a great time. Doot, 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 doot. There it is.
That story was produced by Jenny Cataldo and BMP Audio. Of all the characters in Walk on the Wild Side, the only one who's still alive is Joe D'Alessandro. Lou Reed died in 2013.
Standing on the corner.
Let's say you want to listen to another Lou Reed song from his Velvet Underground days. You could easily stream a flawless digital copy.
And me, I'm in a rock and roll band.
Or if you were determined to listen to it the way it was originally released and played, you'd get a vinyl copy.
All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
For fanatics, the hunt for those old vinyl records can be epic. You can go to record stores that still specialize in vinyl, garage sales, go on eBay, root around your Uncle Herman's basement. But what if you lived in Indonesia? As the CD era began in the 1980s, record pressing in this country slowed down a lot, but in Indonesia, it was totally ended. The machines dismantled and sold for scrap. Production stopped. Reporter Ian Cross was in Jakarta recently and sent us this postcard about how serious record collectors do in a world of scarcity.
I'm in the middle of Jakarta. The street is called Jalan Surabaya. The buildings are low, and most of them are packed with discount luggage and antiques. But in the middle of the block, a string of shops sells used records. It's the old guard of Jakarta vinyl.
Okay, siapa namanya lagi, Pak?
Leon.
This is Leon. He owns one of those shops.
Awalnya ayah saya mulai bisnis.
His father started selling records on Jalan Surabaya in 1963. Leon, and that is his full name, by the way, he began helping out at the market when he was still in elementary school. He's in his 50s now, so he knows the record trade well. Back in the 70s, they sold their records from a kaki lima, basically a small cart that street vendors use. Every day, he wheeled his goods out to the market, selling secondhand LPs at dirt cheap prices, mostly British and American pop.
The Beatles, ada saya, Queen, terus Jefferson Airplane.
There were plenty of Indonesian records too, of course.
Aka, Dara Puspita, Ari Rusli.
At least there were plenty back in the 70s. That was before cheap cassettes put an end to vinyl production in Indonesia. Now, the few domestic records in the shop are looking pretty worn. The covers are faded, and the sound is scratchy. The story in the U.S. is different. Despite all this talk of a record revival, vinyl production never actually stopped in America. Even at the height of the CD era, record factories kept running. But in Indonesia, the last pressing machines were sold for scrap metal in the 80s. But that didn't mean Indonesians stopped loving vinyl. Leon first noticed the resurgence back in 2007. Instead of the usual old-timers and the occasional tourist, it was local teenagers who were coming in and scouring the bins in his shop. The demand hasn't let up since. And his biggest challenge now? Finding more records to sell. Leon picks up about 10 new records every 2 months, so the selection is not great, and most of his shelves are lined with CDs and cassettes. But vinyl records are not in short supply, just on the other side of town. I'm at a place called Pasar Santa. It's kind of a traditional market on Jakarta's south side. Downstairs, you know, it's fruits and spices. But upstairs, it's a slice right out of Brooklyn. Trendy coffee shops, boutique clothing, and lots of records. The vendors here are younger, and they've found a new source for records. At least, for certain kinds of records.
So we have 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 80s disco and 90s, and a lot of indies in newer decades.
My focus is dance music, like house, like Detroit house, like techno, like tech house and disco, new disco.
Lately, I'm into New Yorkan Latin Boogaloo and everything, and sometimes I also play dub.
The stalls don't open till 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and by sundown, the place is packed. When the Muslim call to prayer echoes over the neighborhood, no one seems to notice. And Smoke on the Water plays on. That record has most likely come a long way to wind up in a bin at Pasar Santa.
70% I can say I get from Europe, from Japan.
This is Samson Fo. He's the owner of Laid Back Blues Records, and he looks the part, with a trendy, sculpted mustache.
Sometimes my friends coming back from U.S., he brought me back some records from the like $1 bin because I can sell like at least $50 or $10 here, at least.
It seems everyone has a well-placed supplier. A friend who goes to college in San Francisco, or a connection in the U.K., but the imports are not cheap. At Samson's shop, Dizzy Gillespie goes for at least 300,000 rupiah, or $30. Three Dog Night fetches about the same.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
So is the price of vinyl has really gone up recently?
Yeah, yeah. Since, like I tell you, since 2012. You know, I used to get record in Jalan Surabaya for like less than $1.
There's no dollar bin in Samson's shop. I mean, you're lucky to find an album for less than $10. And the most expensive records are the ones he does not import, the old Indonesian LPs. Those, he tracks down himself.
You know, like the pickers, I go travel around Indonesia, go to the radio station, go to the old label and everything just to buy the old stocks.
He looked around to see if he had any of those records on hand. He found one. Shake Me by the Indonesian group Aka.
Three, shake me! Yeah! Yeah, yeah, I'm selling out. We do the shake.
This is the original copy. But yeah, this is very, you know, like heavy, heavy funk.
The price tag is heavy too. About $100. And keep in mind, this is in a country where you can eat a basic meal for a dollar, and almost half the population lives on $2 a day. So why pay so much for a plastic disc?
Now watch me.
Because the reason is quality, man.
That's Andy Anadia. He's another collector and record vendor in Jakarta.
Yeah, because until right now, in my phone, I don't have music in digital. I hate that.
But vinyl, on the other hand?
If you have one, it's everlasting, man. Everlasting, yeah? And you give, you can tell a story about the cover, tell a story about the song. Oh, I have story with this song. I have story with my girls. Goosebumps, man.
For Anadia, it's the Indonesian records that carry the most stories.
When I'm 5 years old, my parents give me 12 cassettes of Kus Plus. You know Kus Plus, the legendary band from Indonesia. They have 155 albums. You can look at that. Kus Plus, Kus Plus, Kus Plus. any kind of music, roncong, Jawa, Melayu, jazz, pop. And my father told me, oh, this is an Indonesian style, and just like roncong. Sometimes before I go to sleep, he always story about the roncong. This is story when we go to the war, politics in that area, 60s, 70s, 80s, just like them.
And for Samson Foe, too, the most precious records are not the far-flung imports, but the local finds. I was a little surprised to hear that, because almost all the records for sale in his shop are U.S. releases. But as it turns out,
I keep all my favorite records at my home.
And in case you're wondering why he would sell his original pressing of Shake Me, even for $100, well,
I have four of this. That's why I'm selling it here. But for me personally, the Indonesian kind of music that I really like and I really value it, that you will never find that at my shop because I always keep it. That's the thing.
Ian Cross brought us that story from Jakarta. Coming up, the next trend in music, smell-o-vision.
We blindfolded the audience and dispersed the scent for each song throughout the set.
The band Snowblink explains why their music doesn't stink. They'll play for us live in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
Thanks to one of the groovy people I work with here, I recently discovered this terrific band called Snowblink. It is a duo made up of Daniela Gesundheit, that's her real name, bless her, and Dan Goldman. So I invited them here to Studio 360, and as I watched them in our studio setting up, I saw Daniela do something I had never seen before. She took her Gibson guitar out of its case and then attached something very curious to it. You have antlers on your guitar.
I do.
Why? And what are they from?
I've been told they're caribou. My brother found them in Alaska, and I took them from my grandparents' cabin near Yosemite. And I don't think my grandma knows that yet. Hi, Grandma. But I maybe like a decade ago had a dream. Before I moved to Canada, I had a dream that my guitar had moose antlers. And this was kind of the best I could do. Moose would really throw the balance on the SG a little off. So.
Are there any other dreams you make real in that way?
Oh, yeah. Make dreams come true all the time.
Yeah. Mm. Well, instead of just talking about this, will you play a song?
Sure.
And this will be which one?
I guess we could start with How Now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Sweet sap.
That was Snowblink playing How Now, Daniela Gesundheit on lead vocals and guitar, Dan Goldman on backup vocals, guitar and bass, and Phil Melanson played drums. That's a very pretty song.
Thank you.
You have, or some of you, one of you, both of you have described your music as non-denominational devotional pop music,
mm-hmm.
which means what?
First of all, it's not the genre, that genre is not some sort of like, you know, sort of decoy or like secret yeah. agenda to be like, and you
to join the cult.
My religion.
Yeah.
But it is true that my personal musical training, I guess, is it almost exclusively in devotional music. So I am drawn to that.
You studied Indian music in college.
Yeah, I studied South Indian classical voice, which yeah. is all religious devotional music. And then I studied Jewish cantorial music as well.
Do a little cantorial stuff. What does that
little,
sound like?
A little number? You want a little number?
For listeners who've never perhaps been in a temple.
Oh, one of the most beautiful prayers is sung at a wedding. It's called the El Melei Rachamim. I'm not going to be able to do the whole thing from memory, but like... El Melei Rachamim Shochein Bamromim המצאים מנוחה נכונה תחת כנפי השכינה.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. So when you start writing a song, are there rituals involved?
We usually argue right from the beginning. We get that out of the way, and then yeah. we can move forward and start yeah. writing. Yeah.
Do you? Yeah.
We do, actually. Yeah. I mean, like, there's usually an argument at the beginning of every rehearsal period or writing period. It kind of just sort of clears, like, staging the air.
Although, for this album that you wrote together, mm-hmm. Returning Current, you did a thing, I'm told, that you hadn't done before. The mood thing? Board?
Oh, the mood board. Once the songs were written, I'd gathered pictures and sort of impressionistic words about what I was hoping we would achieve. I mean, thankfully, Dan can actually translate things like flash flood in Santa Fe into something technical like more delay. Or like, uh-huh. you know, he can be my translator because I'm sort of just hearing things in like a visual
Yeah, I speak
world.
DSL, Daniela, as a second language.
Good.
And that's probably because you guys have been working together for a decade. You got married in 2009 and... You separated not long ago, as soon as you finished this new record. And I wondered how that is working out for you as a band.
What do you think, Dan?
Well, we haven't started writing songs together yet.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, that'll be another start. Yeah. We've toured.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's been going great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, it's
so do you feel like, well, you're the most civilized humans ever that you can do this?
Totally. No.
It's taken some time. We took a good few months off, mm-hmm. you know, not working together.
Right.
You know, let things gestate.
You guys have had two projects called Returning Current.
Mm-hmm.
You've had on previous albums songs called Sea Change and Pray for Surf and Ambergris. So oceanic.
That's so oceanic.
Why are you so oceanic?
Yeah, that is mine. Dan pointed at me. I have lived on the beach since before I was born, and I've also had a recurring tidal wave dream since I was five or so.
A scary recurring tidal
wave? Well, you know, they were scary for a long time, and at this point, it's just sort of like, there's the tidal wave. They're not scary anymore.
So when the tsunami happens, you'll be all set.
I'll be set.
And ambergris.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I discovered that the first time I read Moby Dick, but
yeah.
remind our listeners what ambergris is.
All right, so ambergris is something that is excreted from a whale, the sperm whale, I believe, and it's worth more than its weight in gold. It's used for perfumery. I got to smell it recently there's like a perfume museum in Los Angeles called the Institute for Art and Olfaction. And it's an outrageous smell.
And that Institute of mm-hmm. Art and Olfaction, you performed there as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We'll talk about that. What was that about?
So we put on a show in July where we collaborated with the owner of the Institute for Art and Olfaction, Saskia Wilson-Brown. She designed a custom scent for each of the songs in our set.
Huh.
And we worked together. I gave her, you know, ideas for
a mood board.
Totally. And from there, she made these amazing blends, and we blindfolded the audience and dispersed the scent for each song throughout the set.
Really? And you guys were both featured on what was, as far as we know, the first record album ever recorded in space,
mm-hmm.
by the Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. The album was called Songs from a Tin Can. I want to play a clip of his song, Beyond the Terra.
The fateful flight that ushered in a new era. Beyond the Terra.
He was singing Bowie last time I heard him. How does that work? I mean, he's 150 miles above the Earth. Logistically, how does that work?
He brought a guitar and an iPad with, like, some basic recording software, and he had a little pod that he would just sequester himself to sort of after he's done all the mapping and flying spacecraft to spend the season.
And did he have a track of your orchestral?
No, it was the other way around.
Oh, really?
So yeah, he recorded himself first.
Oh, so it came back down and you had the tape.
Yeah, so essentially when they're saying that it's, you know, the first record recorded in space, it's basically the guitar and the voice.
He's in space.
He's in space, yeah. And then the rest of the stuff was recorded on the Terra.
Yeah. You know, you make music that's recorded in space. You make non-denominational devotional music. You do mood boards. Your ex-spouses working together. Do you ever feel like characters in a Portlandia episode or something? I mean, I love your music and I like you.
Where did you source this water?
I'm just there you go. Exactly.
I just want to make sure that
it's free range.
It's free range. Yeah, local.
Yeah,
locally
it's
sourced.
Very local.
Artisanal.
Very local. Exactly.
Great.
Exactly.
We're good.
Daniela Gesundheit, and I love saying your name. Daniela Gesundheit and Dan Goldman, thank you very, very much for
Thanks for having us, Kurt.
Thank you so much.
And will you play us out with one more song?
Definitely.
And this will be?
Feel Like a Man.
Mm-hmm. Ready, Phil? I feel like a man.
That's Snow Blink playing Feel Like a Man from their new album called Returning Current. And that's it for this week's show. But before I go, I want to wish a very fond farewell to two of our great producers who are off to new adventures. Matt Frassica and Julia Lowry Henderson both started here as interns, and before I knew it, they were both producing astonishingly good work. And during their years here, I saw that they really had the whole package: conscientiousness and taste and intelligence and audio chops. And they're both very good eggs, really all you could ask in a couple of colleagues. I already miss them. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. And if you like what you heard, you may and should subscribe to our podcast feed at iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. By the way, if you missed our 2016 election special about how our culture coughed up the hairball of Donald Trump and how politics have morphed into show business over the last several decades, then you're fired. But not really. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Krista Ripple,
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bizzeri,
Joaquin Kotler,
Zoe Saunders,
Gabriella Cortez,
Judy Gu,
Jackie Harris,
and I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening.
You're terrific. My God, you should have a university appointment.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we're always going on and on about creativity. In fact, we don't know what we're talking about.
When you start to study it and start to try to figure out what it is and specify its constituents, it becomes more and more and more confusing. Nobody agrees on what it is.
The truth about creativity. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.